You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is a podcast from comedianscomedian.com.
This is the Comedian's Comedian Podcast. Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith. Today we've got the penultimate episode from the Edinburgh Fringe shows recorded last year at the Gilded Balloon. They are the absolutely brilliant Max and Ivan. Hello, hello, welcome.
Hi.
Welcome. Thank you so much for coming, guys.
Thank you for having us.
Do take that out of the thing, and then Ivan can occasionally have a pop on that.
Hello.
Hiya.
Nailing it.
So, just for the benefit of anyone here who hasn't seen your meteoric rise or any of your work, can you just tell us what your show is? What sort of thing do you do?
Yeah, so we're a comedy double act, and we tend to perform sort of narrative character-based shows, which feature kind of sketch-like bits, but tend to tell some kind of story over the course of an hour. At least that's the idea. Featuring various characters and kind of interweaving plot lines and things, all coming to some sort of culmination at the end of it all.
Yeah, we started our narrative journey 2 years ago with Holmes and Watson.
This sounds like a reality TV show.
Yeah.
Your narrative journey.
Our narrative journey.
How is your dream?
Yeah. And last year we did a heist thriller called Con Artist. And this year we kind of took it down a bit, less explosions and adventures. And it's basically a love story.
Sure. So your show's called The Reunion.
Yeah.
And was that a deliberate... When you say you took it down a bit, was that... a conscious attempt to give it... The thing I keep reading in all of your reviews is that you now have more room to breathe. Because I saw the Con Artist show, yeah, and it was tremendous fun, and there was a great bit with laser pens when you were kind of breaking into a place. Yeah, it was really good fun. I saw it in Melbourne where you were nominated for the Barry Award, and which is their equivalent of... I was going to say Perrier, that's hopelessly outdated. Their equivalent of the Edinburgh Comedy Award.
Formerly known as.
And that had loads and loads of sort of rambunctious, leaping around, sweaty, quick character change fun. So was it a deliberate decision to do something different?
Sort of. I think what it was... Oh,
we should say for people, it's a school reunion, is there?
Yeah, it's called The Reunion. It's based on a school reunion, the class of 2003, coming back together for their 10-year school reunion. And we play the sort of the entire school year and all the teachers and friends and lovers and enemies and things all kind of reuniting for one night. I think what it was a conscious decision to move away from what seemed to be perceived as genre parody things, which hadn't really been anything we'd thought about. We just thought about worlds that we'd like to inhabit, and we thought a heist would be a fun place, and you've got lots of characters you can play around with. We wanted to tell a story that was entirely more grounded in reality than anything that we'd done before. And I got a Facebook message from someone I went to school with saying, "Hey guys, I've just realised it's 10 years since we've all done our GCSEs. Why don't we do this?" And then so they were suggesting a school reunion. At which point, on one of those Facebook group message things where friends can invite other friends into the conversation, so you started seeing all these sort of old social groups that you'd long forgotten about sort of reforming. And very vividly, you could see that, like, you know, Sophie Thompson was inviting Carly Morris and Kelly Campbell. It's like, oh yeah, I remember those guys. They used to hang around. And then suddenly, you could see this entire sort of school year vividly reforming. And then Facebook's one of those things whereby you can look at people, even if you don't talk to them. You know, they added you as a friend ages ago, and suddenly you've got these kind of people from your past, and you can see some of them have got married, sure, some of them have had kids, some of them have changed genders or whatever. So, not actually hasn't happened, but that I know of. But it would be, but yeah, but we just started kind of toying around with this idea of a school reunion. And we wondered, and we thought if we did it, it would have to have a more human kind of core to the whole thread of the show than, a big heightened sort of 1920s Sherlock Holmesian romp or something with killer robots. Or a lasery heist thriller set in Las Vegas. And that was the sort of challenge that we set ourselves.
Do you think this is your best show? Do you think it's appropriate that this is the one that's got nominated for the Edinburgh Award?
I think it's our best show, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I love it so much. And it's just been so much fun to perform every night. And to get laughs from an audience is amazing, but to get people crying, which has happened, is amazing. And to get those gasps when things happen and... they're all hanging on the edge of their seats going, we want this character to... We want there to be a happy ending and we want this to happen.
What intrigues me about your show is that I'm reacting to it, as I think a lot of audience members are, as if it's proper theatre. Probably more so. I'm probably feeling more about your show than an ex-failed actor. I don't go and see theatre anymore. I've shrugged it off. But the theatre I do remember seeing, it sort of seemed impenetrable. And yet you are kind of doing it stupidly, but I'm really emotionally engaged with it. The characters that you've got with, Brian, this sort of character who's riddled with every allergy and disease under the sun, is kind of a cartoon character. And yet we're all engaged with you, as much as if we were watching proper theatre.
This is time for me to crowbar in my favourite piece of theatre that the universe has ever conceived, which is, of course, Jerusalem by Jez Butterworth, which you must all go and see at some point in your lives because it's a monumental work of art. But the point is, I went to see it, and one of the many reasons why it's so amazingly brilliant, and I'm not comparing our show to it in the slightest, but the technique...
Too late! You've already compared
it. The technique that he uses... is it starts off as a broad farce, and like the first 45 minutes, you're just laughing, and there's lots of crude jokes and a bit of smut and some pop culture references, and it's very broad. And then over the course of the next 2 hours, it turns into a kind of metaphysical, mystical sort of tragedy and hymn to the English countryside. Mm-hmm. But because your defences are down at the start, and you just let yourself laugh, and you kind of give yourself over to it, by the end, you're in bits and you're a wreck. Mm. And I just think if you can make people laugh, then that's the hardest emotion to kind of to get them feeling, and you can and everything else can kind of come after that. So the aim was to have a character that, or a series of characters that people could care about. Which we've been delighted with. I think people have been.
Brian was one of the first characters we ever wrote for some reason. And this is many moons ago. So Max and I met at university. It was there that we went up to Edinburgh for the first time in the worst play I've ever been in.
Name the play.
It's called Rose Gets Shot.
Nice. Okay.
And it was a film noir performance in which we were all in black and white makeup.
For the benefit of the listener, Max is hanging his head in shame.
Yeah, it was terrible. Somehow we managed to get Scotsman Pick of the Week. I don't know how.
Very good.
It really did. But whilst we were here, we just fell in love with the festival and we started writing comedy.
I'm just going to go back to Rose Gets Shot because it was directed and written by this completely lazy woman. And she was and the script didn't exist, but she was like, oh, I've come up with this thing at the end where there are these like letters and it's going to we've worked out it would like be an anagram and that'll be the big reveal. And we all stood around and we were like, that's not actually an anagram. Like, it doesn't work.
Yeah, Rose Gets Shot, it's an anagram of to get her. And we said, no, that there are still two S's and a full stop.
And she was like, yeah, but I'm dyslexic, aren't I?
Wow.
Well, actually, no, so in the my line, but I was playing a detective and I had to look at this look at this letter that said Rose Gets Shot, and I put the letters in order and I went, to get her, SS. And then the final O, stop. one of the letters became a punctuation.
Okay, so was that... So have you... I mean... do you have positive experiences of theatre? I mean, obviously, you mentioned Jerusalem. Or was it in doing that that you thought, well, I mean, this is risible?
Whilst we were performing this, I mean, we came up to Edinburgh. We were in this terrible show every day, an hour long. We just did it as a job. Straight after us were a theatre company from Warwick University called Dumb Show, and they were doing a show called To the End of the World, and they're doing a show right now called The Pearl, okay, based on Steinbeck's novel. It's amazing, and they are such a beautiful theatre company, and we saw that, and it was the polar opposite of what we were doing. They transported us into this amazing world, and it was just beautiful, absolutely brilliant, and well, that made me quite upset that we were doing this shit fest. But but whilst we were in Edinburgh, we just there was so much creativity that we started writing, and we ended up writing 6 45-minute radio episodes in the month somehow.
Speculatively,
So speculatively means did we know did they have a home, or did we just write them for fun? Okay. Nice save. Yes, that's all right, champ. Yes.
I'm going to throw in more long words now to see how many Ivan gets.
The flicker of fear. No, they sort of had a home. Basically, Insanity is the student radio station that we had at the time, and we just asked this bloke if we could write a radio show. We didn't really know how any of it worked, and he was like, yeah, sure. And then we were like, 45-minute episodes? And he was like, yeah, fine. And there, yeah, somehow, in amongst the nonsense and the madness of our first ever Edinburgh Fringe experience, yeah, we wrote like 4.5 hours worth of scripted comedy, which we then recorded when we got back to England, which is, to this day, I think, probably the most productive we've ever been by about 700%.
Yeah.
But yeah, I forget why we started talking about that. But,
Brian, the character who's in our show, was in that radio series.
Okay.
And we I don't know why, but we kept in the expotainment zone. Do you not remember Craig?
Come on,
Craig
Max, we all remember the expotainment zone.
Craig and Brian. There was this horrible relationship. Max played this guy Craig, who was completely besotted with himself, and Brian was this just lovable, disease-ridden character who just had nothing but love for Craig.
Okay.
And so over the series, it built up, and there were just horrible scenarios.
Are you good actors? Do you think that you are good actors, or are you getting away with kind of daft acting because we're within the sphere of comedy?
I think it'd be awful to just sit there and go, we are good actors.
We are good actors. We are very good actors. But no, I think, fuck it, I think we are. And,
yeah, that's what we want, come on.
And what I've loved is seeing in reviews and people talking about how wonderful Max plays a girl.
Yes, that is very,
and it's
very
not
good.
Played for laughs.
Sure.
He plays this beautiful character, and everyone completely just gets on board with the fact that he's a woman, and this is just this love story that's going through. And in fact, we were thinking about ending the show with a kiss, because it would have been a wonderful way to finish. But then we thought, that's going to take people out of this world, and they're suddenly going to go, oh, it's two guys kissing.
Sure.
But at some points, I think there have been a couple of shows in which, had that kiss happened, they would have just completely carried on going with it.
Sure, okay. Okay, well, let's talk about the process of creating the show, because I know you were directed by Tom Parry.
Yes, yes.
And a lot of us are familiar with Tom's work as a member of Pappies.
Lovely Tom.
And I think there are, I mean, I sort of thought afterwards that Tom's kind of fingerprints feel like, Tom's awesome fingerprints feel like they're all over your show. Because
he's very handsy.
Yeah, sure. Because what kind of knocked Pappies into a bigger league last year was the fact that their show went for dicking about with emotion rather than just dicking about.
Mm.
And it seems like you've made a similar decision. So tell us about Tom's involvement and how much of what came from who.
Well, he's been absolutely fantastic. It's the first time that we've been directed by Tom. The previous two shows were directed by the deeply wonderful Jessica Ransom, who was too busy to direct us this year, and we were a bit gutted at that point when we realised that we weren't going to have her, and we kind of felt a bit adrift. So yeah, we're delighted to get Tom on board.
Yeah, absolutely. And we we came to him after Melbourne with the show structure, and we said this is the journey we want to take people on.
Okay.
It wasn't him saying, I think you should go for the emotional angle or anything like that. We definitely came with this thing, and we wrote the very first version of the show without any of his input. We did it in Brighton at the end of May, and then he shouted at us for not having booked in enough previews. Mm-hmm. We had about 9, and he said that Pappy's did about 27 or something. So we booked in 25 previews in 2 months, and then he was instrumental in the shaping of this very loose thing that we had into this lovely tight hour.
And you listen to, I mean, I've listened to Pappy's interview here and things, and you obviously, if you see Pappy's perform, Tom is this disruptive force and this kind of loose cannon. He's got this maverick sort of energy about him, which is very compelling to watch as a performer, but we didn't know as a director whether what that would mean, what that would translate into. But it turns out he's an absolute technician, and very much all of his notes are framed by the structure of the show and what should go where and why and how to get the most out of each gag and things. And he's so technically minded, and there's so much sort of stagecraft and things go into the way that he thinks about the show. So all, which must mean that all of the, you know, everything Pappy's does is, you know, probably with the exception of their Advocaat shows, is carefully thought about and pre-planned and crafted.
I know Tom has a preoccupation with that. He often says, I've heard him say socially, that that the mistake a lot of shows make is to try and make audiences laugh and think. And what he feels you should do is try to make audiences laugh and feel. And that seemed to me, that really, that kind of was very clear in my head when I was watching your show going, oh, that's great. There's no kind of message here, but you've gone for a sort of an archetypal love story that I'm engaged with. And so it's sort of uncluttered. Meaning-wise, you know what I mean?
Well, we've always been interested in telling stories involving characters, and we've never been polemicists. We've never had a sort of, you know, a kind of...
What does that mean, mate?
It's like taking an extreme point of view within an argument and kind of really pushing that through. As you can see, we've never been polemicists. We're interested in telling simple stories that Ivan can learn and then perform.
When we did Holmes and Watson, Max was quite insistent that I maybe should read some of the Holmes and Watson.
One stage.
I didn't even bother watching the films. He gave me all the audiobooks, but I didn't give that a try either.
Don't stress your brain out, champ, you know.
So this is Max and Ivan. I mean, obviously, they're incredibly nice guys. They're super talented. Their show, The Reunion, was absolutely sensational. You just want to slap them, really. They're in Melbourne at the moment. Oh, probably by the time you hear this, they'll have just come back from Melbourne, where I'm sure they had a fantastic time. And great stuff hearing from them. This is just going to be a very quick blurb from me. You'll all be relieved to know. Just to let you know that I am away at the moment. I'm going to try and get episode 74 to you, which will be the final episode with the wonderful Claudia O'Doherty. We're going to try and get that out on time next week, same time next week, Wednesday, or occasionally Thursday, if we have to. And then probably we'll have a gap. There'll be a week's pause before episode 75, just because I'm travelling, because I'm off to New Zealand. If you're in New Zealand, if you're anywhere near Auckland or Wellington, or can get yourself to either of those places, do come and see my show there. It's called He Wolf, and is my new hour-long show that I'm going to be doing in New Zealand for 3 weeks, then taking up to Edinburgh. James Acaster is going to be there as well. Sarah Pascoe, John Robbins. There's some fabulous guys doing the big show. Michael Legg will be there. John Gordillo. And too many to mention. Apologies to anyone I've forgotten. Chris Martin and Carl Donnelly, of course, will be out there doing their shows and their podcast. And I will be doing a Comedian's Comedian with Carey Marks. I'm going all the way to New Zealand to interview someone who lives 4 miles away from me. He's obviously exciting and international out there, so why not do someone really exciting? And I've wanted to do Carey for ages. I nearly did a podcast with him early last year sometime when we were doing the skiing gigs. Might even have been 2 years ago. So I've had some brilliant conversations with Carey, really got his head screwed on about comedy, has got some fascinating views on on offensiveness in comedy, many of which I'm fairly sure from our last conversation I disagree with. So hopefully sparks will fly. I'm sure that'll be an interesting conversation. So you can come along and see that at the Classic in Auckland, brilliant year-round comedy club in Auckland. That is on in a few weeks. Check the internet for details, really. I don't have the details in front of me, which is ridiculous given the autonomy in creating a postcard podcast. Christ on a bike. This is what happens when I try and rush this, because I've got a lot on. I'm sorry. I don't want you to feel like I'm rushing our time together, although I know that from your point of view, our time together really doesn't consist of these bits. Anyway, where was I? Yes, come and see He Wolf in New Zealand. I will be recording a live episode with Carey Marks, and I'm also going to try and grab a bunch of other Kiwi comics while I'm over there, because there's such an amount of talent over there, a huge amount of talent, that I would like to make you aware of, particularly if you're listening in Britain, so that when those guys come over here for the Edinburgh Festival, you can know who they are in advance. It's just trying to do my bit in bringing new stuff to you that you won't have heard of. So that's all of that. Thank you for sending in your hashtag all show no business ideas. We've had some lovely ones of those. We'll go into them in a bit more detail next week, maybe award some sort of rubbish prize. I think that's everything I need to say. I feel like there's something I've forgotten. Normally I read this bit off a bit of paper, having written it all down in advance, but I didn't do that this time. I thought, no, I'll just wing it. I'll be fine. I'm not fine. I can't remember what else I'm supposed to be advertising. It's something, two things in New Zealand. Come on, that's obvious. And what's the... I've run out of steam completely now. If I remember it, I'll get back to you. Oh, that's it! Of course, we're doing Edinburgh. We're doing an Edinburgh one. We're doing five shows at Bob's Bookshop next year. I might do more when I'm up there around people's houses. Sorry you had to sit through that bit while I remember what I'm talking about. It's like someone telling you, oh, I had this fascinating dream last night. Yeah, really? Please don't bore me with the details. We're doing five shows in Bob's Bookshop, which is on the Heroes of Fringe, one of the four free fringes. And that's going to be at 11 o'clock on five different nights. So the 10th, I think, and then 17th, 18th, 19th and 20th of August. I don't know who I'm going to get for those yet. I've got a feeling Phil Kay is going to be one of them. I wanted to do Phil for a long time. And there's a couple of other ideas I've got floating around for those. If you'd like to suggest any, you can tweet me at ComComPod or email me info@comedianscomedian.com. I like it when people get in touch with me via those methods, because it means they're listeners of the podcast rather than people, like PR people, who just like going, hey, take my act. And so if you can get some suggestions in, that'd be great. And that is everything I need to say. Thank you for bearing with me. Let's get back to the brilliant Max and Ivan.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Let's talk about your dynamic as a double act. How much of what we're seeing now reflects the truth of your situation?
Too much. This is all true. We're not
okay.
Not, this is a documentary type situation. This is for posterity.
Okay. Yeah. Because what it seems like from the outside, it seems like you are the kind of debonair. I mean, you know, for the benefit of the listener, you appear to have a knitted tie, even.
I do have
which
a knitted
is,
tie.
There we
absolutely.
Go. So you know, you dress like a dandy, and you wear a lot of jumpers.
A fair assessment.
Yeah. So is that how much of your dynamic as a double act now was there when you started working together?
I don't know. Well, I mean, I don't think our dynamic isn't down to my knitted ties and Evan's jumpers. So that's, I mean, in fact, we've probably changed the clothes that we wear. That's sort of incidental. But I suppose we've always had
a similar core like performing dynamic that's kind of bounced off between us. We've always played different status characters together and made them clash off one another. We started working together when I was I saw Evan do some solo character comedy at university, and then I went off on tour wrestling around Italy for a weekend, and I couldn't speak Italian, so I was very bored and a bit depressed. But I had this sort of weird notion of writing a character that would be complementary to Evan's, and it was a kind of Argentinian kind of folk singer sort of character based on Evan's extraordinary dad Enrique. And I wrote this other character, and then I even wrote a song, and then I sort of came back from my weekend wrestling in Italy and knocked on his halls of residence and said, hello mate, I've written this thing, do you want to give it a bash?
And I had a gig booked in for a few weeks down the line. It was the second ever gig I'd done, and I said, well, that's lucky because I've not written anything, so yeah, absolutely, come on board. And since then Max has written the rest.
Okay, because I remember I've been in a few double acts myself. The last double act I was in was with Richard Sandling.
Indeed.
Where the dynamic kind of grew
kiosk
out of...
Kiosk of Champions.
Thank you. The dynamic grew out
a
of the fact...
A kiosk is basically...
The dynamic grew out of the fact that I was kind of... Or what it became was I was the sort of mainstream, handsome kind of Lothario, whereas he was a 35-year-old man that lives with his mum. And that was kind of based on truth, although I may have aged him slightly. But about that was the kind of the surface dynamic. That was what we saw on stage. That was what we saw played out. Those were the notes we decided to play up. So in terms of, it's fascinating to me. It sounds like what happens is that you have an idea, tell him you're doing it, write it, and then kind of carry him. How much of that is true?
This is the abrasive, interrogative Goldsmith interview style he warned us about at the start.
Don't let it split us up, Ivan. We've got three more shows. We've almost survived the month. Definitely three of the ideas that I had were in the show, so...
How much of this is true?
We've not assessed... We've not gone through, you know, line by line and worked out who's thought of what.
I'm not suggesting for a minute that the fact that, say, one of you were to do more work would mean you were any less of a double act, because obviously we know from other creative environments that one can't exist without the other.
Well, I mean, Max is the one who types the script.
that was my role. Nice.
He's the one who works at the computer, and I kind of lie on the bed and I'm like, yeah, yeah.
I love that there's that even a good. Bed in your writing room. That's
there's a bed. There's a bed. I think we come up with broad ideas to begin with, set pieces. The very first idea we had for this show was the geography scene, in which is a highly sexually charged conversation with just geography. I don't know why we picked on geography, because neither of us did geography GCSE, but
sure.
We just felt that was the way to go.
I think it's probably the sexiest of the core subjects.
So that's such a brilliant scene in which a mature student is chatting up her ex-teacher.
Yeah.
And they're talking in geographic terms.
Absolutely. And I'm trying to think whose idea that was. But we've got some. Was that okay? It was Max's. Fine. But another one is a clash of a musical instrument fight, which incorporates a sketch that we wrote a while ago, which was based on an air guitar championship.
Okay.
And did you? I think I came up with the air guitar sketch, so I'm going to take that one.
Okay.
But what I'm trying to say is that we come up with ridiculous ideas, we bounce off each other, and then Max says if we're allowed to use them or not.
Okay. And is that right? That broadly represents the...
Maybe. I mean, we always write together. Like, I know Pappy's have a two-man system and the Pythons used to all hate each other or something, but we always... like write the entire show, and like it would take, we'd have to be really close to the wire or a deadline for us to write separately and email like email stuff across. That's never how we prefer to work. So even
sure.
I'll tend to do like the majority of the typing due to my extraordinary word speed. But we're kind of, you know, we'll sit in the room and I mean we both prefer it, ideally getting away from the computer is the best thing at the start, and you know, just bits, you know, infinite bits of paper or post-it notes on a thing, get like sorting out the structure of the show.
So you start with the set pieces and then get a sense of what story might contain those.
Sort of. I mean, especially when it comes to, you know, creating an hour-long show, you kind of need to, at the very start, it's like this massive sort of edifice and you sort of just tackle it from kind of any angle you can and you just try and make as many inroads as you can from any sort of side. So we kind of simultaneously sat in our room in Melbourne and discussed how, you know, who out of the people we remember going to school with, who would be a central figure, how many central figures we could have, how many different kind of threads we could weave together in the course of that hour, where we might want to end up at the end, and then onto the sort of big scenes.
I think the way we've adjusted the way we write over the past few years, because I think I remember with Holmes and Watson, we just wrote the first 15 minutes and we were like, oh, this is brilliant, this is so much fun. And then we thought, okay, we're here now, what the hell do we do? And we kind of just kept writing in a certain direction. We didn't really have a clue how it was going to end or where it was going. And then suddenly it made sense. And then you could take a step back from it and go, actually, sure, if we do these changes here, here, and here.
In the end, Moriarty shed his bulletproof skin and Al Capone's bomb went off and then everyone died. So, we got there in the end,
you
guys.
Natural.
Don't worry.
When you look back on it like that, it seems natural.
Yeah,
so are you writing the whole show before you perform any of the show?
Well, this time around, because of where the Melbourne Comedy Festival fell within our year, normally, and then we knew it would be there, normally we'd start in December or January, kind of starting to write the beginnings of the show. And then you can, when you've got 10 minutes, you may as well preview them around in various places. And then you get to that tricky bit where you've got like half an hour or 40 minutes, and it's like either you don't or you book it or you split an hour or something. But this time, because Melbourne was sort of there at the time when we'd normally be doing the start of the show, we ended up writing the whole thing and just getting back. And then after the crack of the whip from Parry, just went into this rigorous full-on hour preview sort of mode, which was pretty full-on.
It was full-on, but it was ridiculously brilliant for us, I find it. To do the full hour in front of an audience, and then you can see exactly what worked and what didn't. And then you can work on it with Parry's amazing notes, and then do the hour again in front of an audience. I think it's really important to keep working in front of the audience, because we go, yeah, this is funny. Oh yeah, that'll definitely work. Well, I mean, we've got a secret ending to the show, and throughout all of our previews, we finished without that ending.
Okay.
And then...
because you wanted to keep it secret?
No, just
because it wasn't ready.
Logistically impossible to happen. Like, we can't drive to Cardiff. Yeah, we were relying on it. We knew we had it there, but we were just relying on it working.
So that was the one thing that we kept going, okay, that I'm sure that will work. Okay. And luckily it did.
Okay.
And it pulled off. But apart from that, we like to test everything out in front of audiences and see what feels right. And then as you're performing, you tend to adjust the show itself.
Sure. Something I really like that I only realised in retrospect is you don't do any fake corpsing. You know, like you might be familiar with this from other sketch shows, and it's something that Klang did loads of and Pappy's then did for a while. I mean, I'm talking about corpsing rather than fake corpsing.
Yeah.
Whereby you're making each other laugh on stage and you sort of leave that in because it's fun and boisterous and all the rest of it. And something I've seen in the wake of both Klang and later Pappy's is a lot of other kind of sketch groups kind of go, you guys, like that, and sort of play with that. There's something very clean about your work that you kind of keep it simple, and each idea has its own moment.
Luckily, we've never found each other funny, so that's a real boon when it comes to we've discussed it before. I think in our formative years, when we were at university, when we were doing shows, there were a few where we'd have you'd build in these rooms, these bits for corpusing. But what we discover very quickly is that audiences are not stupid, and there's something really genuinely magical about when something goes totally wrong and someone cracks and it's all there and there's this wonderful intimate moment and it's brilliant. And there's something incredibly hollow and cynical and shit about trying to recreate it the next day.
Sure.
All the timing feels forced and it just becomes... it becomes the complete opposite of that first moment. So we basically agreed from then on not to have anything. And if something does, you know, if something, no, just be natural. If something happens, let then fine, and you could like always have fun with the show, always enjoy doing it, always muck around with it. If something does go wrong, that doesn't ruin the rhythm or the flow or the arc. But definitely don't have a bit where, fingers crossed, you're so funny that I fluff my lines and then we have a bit of a matey and jokey moment tonight. That would be nice.
Are there other principles and that you've kind of gone, right, we don't do this?
I wonder.
Well, okay, there's another way of asking.
With this show, we had a principle that we didn't want to go down the... We definitely didn't want to do what felt like the most obvious gag of pervy teacher and young boy type, like dodgy teacher thing. So we wanted to make sure that in the geography sketch, for example, she was a mature student so that it was an equal relationship.
I think we've got a couple of moments of audience interaction that are quite carefully scripted into the show. And I think what we really wanted to do was make that audience member feel like a hero.
Absolutely. And you really do that as well. You're not taking advantage of the audience member.
Because, I mean, it's really easy to get someone up on stage and make them feel like a dick and have people laugh at them. And that's just horrible.
Hugely successful.
Yes.
As well. And I say that because I really approved of it. I felt it like you had really good quality control. Not that it's, you know, my place to approve of anything, but I remember thinking, nice one. You're giving that to the audience member. It's like you go, here's an offer, and they can kind of take it to what extent they want. And ideally what you want is they overreach themselves and are surprised by what they do. And then it's lovely. As opposed to do something feminine and, you know, everyone laughs.
Yeah. It's a lovely moment in the show. And we've had a lot of people say, is that a plant? Was that, you know, are they supposed to do this and that? And it's great when they do something completely unexpected. But I take the first 10 or 15 minutes whilst we're doing the show to carefully gauge my front row and pick that right person who I think is going to be the good person that's going to do the ridiculous things.
Sure.
And normally the guy who's enjoying the show the most and is quite visibly having a good time. Because if someone's sat there sour face going, oh, this is horrible, and then I bring them on stage, then they're clearly not going to want to play ball. But if they're having a good time, then, you know, they're going to be free to do that.
Well, we're on the subject of tropes of sketch shows, and this is something I often enjoy asking stand-ups. What things are there that you see in sketch that you hate?
I'll explain trope later. things that you hate. I don't want to start dishing out like punitive sentences on things that we don't like in sketch. I don't know what. I think we've done a few in the past. Yeah. I think.
Okay. Well, that's another way of doing. What have you done in the past that you're ashamed of?
Oh God, that's another hour. I sort of slightly glaze over if I hear a straight up pop song with the words changed, which is a thing that happens. I think I'm not afraid to put that out there.
We have been victims of this. The nude sketch.
Yep.
I mean, it's
when you say you've been victims of it, you've done
it. We've done it. Yeah, okay. We have. There was a show in which I came out fully nude, and there was two less than 10-year-olds on the front row.
I think that's actually illegal what you've done there. I can bleep this later.
Ivan also had a Union Jack flag inserted in his anus.
Wow.
I must say, though, that our venue technician's cousins, and she had seen the show about 15 times.
And didn't want
them.
And
we said, are you sure they should be in the audience? Because you know what's coming up. And she was like, yeah, they're going to have to learn somehow.
Wow. And about, what a formative experience that was.
About a chubby naked man with a flag in his ass.
So we've kind of, and you know, occasionally, I stand by this. It worked as a sketch, but it was fine. But it kind of did. It sort of overshadowed the rest of the show. It transpired in a way that we didn't think it would. We just thought, that's quite funny. We had to take it in turns to be naked as well, because both of our girlfriends objected to us doing it. So we went into the lose-lose scenario of everyone. Everyone being upset with the whole thing.
We had different flags, by the way.
Okay, good.
There you go. It's the specifics of comedy for you.
So... God, I had another question prepped, and that flag thing just completely took me out of it. Do you engage with the process of comedy criticism? Do you read your reviews? Are there specific pieces of criticism that you've found painful or difficult or accurate or inaccurate.
Max has been very good this month in that he's not read any of the reviews, and I am far too needy. I've got a Google alert that emails me.
Well, thank you for admitting that.
Whenever Max and Ivan comes up on the internet. No, I don't know. But it's funny because I love the show so much, and if there's a bad review, I'll go, well, no, you're wrong. That's wrong. And then if there's a good review, I go, well done.
I had a stab at not reading them last year, but it kind of fell into it. But this year, yeah, just decided not to.
Read. No one else's reviews.
I've stopped reading any reviews, sure, really, because it felt perverse to sort of sit there like a hawk and see what everyone else was getting. Mm-hmm. But yeah, because I came to the conclusion that nothing said was going to affect the way I performed the show or what I did in it, and that I was basing my performance on the 25 previews that we'd done and the rehearsals and the writing process, as opposed to the kind of judgments of a series of writers. So I just opted not to. And also, I try not to get affected. I think if you don't let yourself get affected by the bad ones, then you can't possibly allow yourself to get affected by the good ones either. Mm-hmm. So you kind of just need to compartmentalize it and kind of put it to one side. And I'm sure I'll read them all when I get back from Edinburgh and just see what was said. And also, that's not to say that I disagree. All right, champ. It's not to say that I disagree with reviews, or I think, you know, critics serve a purpose and lots of them are phenomenally good. I think Steve Bennett is a very good analyst and the full-time comedy reviewers. Most of them, yeah, it's great to have people who can contextualize comedy and put people's work, you know, chronologically and analyze people's development and things like that. But yeah, I have not read a word.
I'm just too curious. I don't know. I just have to know. And, you know, it much like if someone said, oh, these people just said this about you, and would you want to know? I'd want to know. I'd want to know what they think, even though that might hurt my feelings. I'm really too curious. I've nothing but admiration for people who can rise above it and go, no, I don't care.
Sure. It's interesting, your two halves of the sort of the debate that I think a lot of comics kind of deal with in their own minds, go, am I going to or not? Sorry, that's the boring alarm, so we better spice this up.
Thank God. It's good to know.
I am going to give the audience the opportunity to ask some questions. If you'd like, raise a hand and we can do that. However, I was going to say what normally happens is there's a bit of an eggy pause while you think of them, and then I'll cover in the meantime. But we have a question from the musical gentleman over there. That's a really good question. We're glossing over a lot of stuff here because we think people are familiar with the terminology, but I'll just ask that again for the sake of the recording. You say you've done 25 or so previews. What are they? Who looks at them? Where do you do them?
Well, we didn't come to ask this question until we'd already booked them all in. So Parry gave us this big, you know, hell-raising speech about previews, boys. And then we were like, yeah! And then we phoned up every theatre in the world and booked them all in. And then we're like, my God, who on earth is going to come to any of these? But somehow, people did.
Yeah, our very first preview had about three people in it, which was lovely. But then...
Surely that's easier to cope with as a sketch act than it is, say, for a stand-up, do you think?
Well, it's a bit...
Because you can sort of plug it in and play and just kind of go for the show.
I guess. I mean, yeah, we can just keep our head down and just go through it. But during that period, you really want to see what the audience go for and what affects them. So in a way, you really do... It'd help if there were more. But we were really lucky. We've had some really lovely London previews, and then we went further afield this year.
Because as it happens, we tend to run regular nights in London anyway, sort of throughout the year. So it wasn't an enormous stretch. I mean, we were certainly doing more than normal, but we had kind of people that would come to our shows regularly anyway. So it was just a question of turning those shows into kind of hour long previews.
Sorry, just for the sake of recording, do you look at that afterwards, or do you have someone external do an analysis of it? I'll also add, do you ever record them and watch them back?
Well, Tom Parry, our director, is become infamous for... He's never given us notes that were shorter than the hour itself. He's always, he's always given us a minimum of about 90 minutes of notes, which raises the question, how can one make 90 minutes of mistakes in a 60-minute show? But we've done it, apparently.
But yeah, so Tom will see the show a lot of times in the audience, and he'll give us notes on that. And we don't record the audio. I know a lot of stand-up comedians will record it, listen back to
it. A lot of them will record it.
But not
listen back.
Not
all of them will listen back to it, yeah.
I tried. I recorded one, and then I think we started to do it, but I don't know. I just didn't enjoy it whatsoever. But I also think that because there's two of us, as soon as we finish every single show, we go, this scene really worked. We've completely messed up this. How do we work on this? And we just work our way through it. And I'll remember the bits that Max did wrong, and Max will remember the things that I did wrong.
Sure. So did you ever clash with Tom? Did he ever give you feedback that you had to dig your heels in?
So when we got to Edinburgh, our show was running at about an hour and 5 minutes, an hour and 6 minutes, which is a complete transgression in Edinburgh. The Edinburgh hour is essentially 55 minutes long, sure. Really. And we've been so immersed in kind of making sure the show was structurally sound that we hadn't noticed that the length of time was creeping up because we were just adding little bits and pieces in. So we got to Edinburgh and suddenly it became a real pressing thing. And we had to cut at the start of the month about 8 minutes from the show. Mm-hmm. So the only time there was ever any tension was working out which bits to cut, because obviously it's a very upsetting experience. And there were bits that we were fighting for and bits that had to go. But in the end, it was fun. Everyone got the bits that they wanted to stay in the show.
What was the bit that you most regret cutting or most missed from the show?
Weirdly, a scene in which Jessica wheels Brian away in a Zorb ball.
Okay.
That was
Actual Zorb ball or a mimed Zorb
ball? Well, just a mimed Zorb ball, yeah. But it was got a big laugh and we loved it. And it showed this relationship between Jessica and Brian. We felt that maybe we were losing. It was a scene in which Brian sticks up for Jessica when she's being bullied. So we felt that we maybe lost a bit in that relationship. But I think the show works better for it now.
Are there any moments, or were there any moments in the structure of the show, in the shape of it, where you sort of thought to yourself, okay, this works in terms of the plot, but it's not funny enough? Or this bit's really funny, but it's confusing the plot, or maybe in the wrong place? Because I imagine when you're telling a chronological story, certain things have to be in certain places.
Plenty. I'm sure there are many, many instances of that, but they all kind of got wrinkled out in the editing process. Because we did so many previews, we ended up redrafting the show a lot more than we've ever done previously. So we did about, I think, 10 or 11 drafts of the script. And once you've got the show as an hour, that is something that people can watch and generally enjoy. That's the point where you start forensically sitting, you know, staring, squinting at the computer screen and going, no, need two jokes here. And sometimes towards the end, you don't know what, you just know what the jokes are or what they're going to be about, but you just know you need something there, something to puncture it there.
And in those situations, just to look very specifically at the joke making process there, when you say to yourself, okay, that needs two jokes, how are you finding the funny in those? How are you brainstorming things? Are you improvising? How do you actually make the stuff? Or is it a case of talking between you, or what can we see when two of you go, right, there's got to be a joke there?
It kind of depends who's saying it. Lots of the characters in the show are quite fun to muck around with and kind of slip into character and start playing around and trying to come up with stuff that they might say. So yeah, lots of improv, lots of sitting around, lots of agonizingly staring at the ceiling.
I think there's one scene in the show that we still would like a joke for.
Sure.
And instead we've settled on just a quick segue into the next scene.
Okay.
So we've just gone swiftly from that into the next, and it kind of just pushes people along, and they probably don't notice that there should be a joke there, but there really should be a joke there. So if anyone comes along, you can tell us what that joke should be, and then we'll pop it in the show.
We'll get 70 different suggestions.
Also, the points at which people shout out might be telling you,
where's the joke? We were quite happy with that scene.
I'll come to the audience for more questions in a moment. I wanted to ask a sort of a comedian's comedian classic question. What elements of your work do you feel, or what elements of sketch do you feel are kind of currently intangible? Are there things you see other people doing that you go, I wish we were a bit better than that, or we're aiming to one day be able to do this or that? It's a good question, this, because if you say nothing, you risk sounding arrogant.
Oh, absolutely. No. Well, the comedians that are the performers that I think are the most extraordinary aren't necessarily sketch comedians, aren't necessarily people who we base our style off. But I was overawed and consistently am overawed at the structure and the beauty of Kitson's writing and the way he expresses ideas with such lyricism and then can express the polar opposite of that idea. I'm really, really getting inside the head of an audience member. But
for the benefit of non-comedy superfans, we're talking about Daniel Kitson, who is...
The wonderful Daniel Kitson, yes, who, if you can ever find a ticket to one of his consistently sold out unadvertised shows, then do go along. And then... Bo Burnham and Tim Key, who are two of the reasons why we pilloried so hard. That's the wrong, completely the wrong one. Don't know where that came from.
Don't worry.
I've outdone myself. I ran out of long words. The reason we lobbied so hard for the Queen Dome, which is the venue that we're in, was because we saw Bo Burnham perform there, his initial show, Words, 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 which was amazing. And Tim Key in the Bath, the Master Slut show.
Sure.
And that, yeah, just both the structure and... better than the alarm. the structure and the the structure and kind of quality of their writing. Like nothing in the hour is wasted.
Mm-hmm. I think there are a lot of amazing comedians that bring a different type of energy to their performance as well. Nick Helm, just this constant barrage of anger and sweat, which I don't think we would ever be able to do, but it's just beautiful to watch. And there's so much out there that's inspiring, but I don't think we would ever want to necessarily do that.
Sure.
But it's definitely wonderful to watch.
That's a great question. Is it essential for you guys to be live performers? Would you be happy? I'm sure you would be happy moving into TV, radio, film maybe, but would you always want there to be a live component to your work?
Well, I think the thing is we massively enjoy live performing and we take great pleasure in the process of writing and developing a show, and then it's lovely to perform it. And sometimes you get the sense that people are slightly transparently coming to Edinburgh viewing it purely as a trade fair, which of course it is, but without any deep-seated love for the work that they're doing.
We love working with the conventions of live shows and playing around with what can you do and what little tricks and, oh, he wasn't there, he was somewhere else all along. Mm-hmm. Given the opportunity, I think we'd love to play with conventions of radio and TV as well and explore what we can do with those things as well. So, but performing live has been amazing and I definitely wouldn't want to give that up.
Is there... For double acts and groups in particular, I think it's hard. One of the reasons why I'm a solo performer now, having been in a couple of double acts, is that I suppose in some internal way I haven't really thought about, I feel like I can rely on myself, I'm not going to break up. Obviously, as stand-ups go, stand-ups frequently break up. but have you thought to the future in terms of the longevity of the double act?
Well, I mean, we've never... Lots of people... seem to be really organized and have like 5-year plans or 10-year plans or secret machinations and world domination ideas. We've only ever had like a vague idea of what we want to do that next, in the immediate year. But as far as staying together, I mean, I remember we had a conversation when we graduated from university. We sat down and said, right, we are now adults, apparently. Are we going to get real jobs or should we carry on doing this thing that we've really enjoyed doing? And we both decided that nope, this is it, we're going to continue writing, we're going to continue performing, that we'll need to work, but that everything will have to kind of be in service to this idea that we've got, that we're going to be performers. And I think it's safe to say in the time since we've been graduated, it's gone far better than we could have possibly hoped.
Yeah, absolutely. And we always said we are going to try and do something better every year than we have done the year before. Mm-hmm. Which sounds quite like a simple thing to set out, but it's quite a lovely objective to try and reach for.
And it was, I think this was possibly on Pappy's interview that they did with you, but it was very nice to hear them say that they sat down and decided that they wanted to work with each other for many years, and they were very happy with this idea. I don't think either of us, certainly neither of us, are striving for our debut solo hours.
Not unless you write it.
we really, really enjoy working together. I think it always seems implausible that this could be like, hey man, love
he's
you.
He's me best pal. I love him to bits.
Love you, man. It seems implausible that this could be a job, and we're delighted that that's the way it's.
When we spoke to you, when we spoke in Melbourne, you had just given up your day jobs because you both had real jobs. You were writing for Esquire and you were making computer games.
Something like that, yeah.
Is that right?
I was working for a game design studio.
Okay.
Designing real life games, but yeah, whatever. No, I mean, they were very, both places were very supportive of what we did. But it got to the point where I sat down with my boss and said, I'm going to Melbourne for a month. And he said, that sounds amazing. Are you also going to do Edinburgh? And I said, yes. And so that's 2 out of 12 months that I wouldn't be in the office. And he said, yeah, I think it's time we let you do your thing, and by all means come back and do some freelance work when you're around, which is
great.
Lovely. But yeah, they recognised that I couldn't really hang around and be shackled to the 10 to 6 hours.
The harrowing working life of a Farringdon-based real-life game designer. I don't know how his constitution copes.
But is there now presumably an imperative? Have you got a sort of a thing in mind where you go, okay, we have to we've got to be able to make this much money from comedy?
Well, there is the fear, yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And we're just kind of feeling our way through it, seeing how it goes.
Have you got a sort of time limit in mind of just we can try this for X amount of time before?
I think the really good thing was that the Melbourne dates forced both of our hands, and we were both in exactly the same boat, because we'd known, you know, it was getting more and more hellish, and you know, we were writing our shows between, you know, 8 p.m. and 4 a.m. and we were never seeing our girlfriends, and we were kind of gradually sort of physically and mentally falling apart. And had Melbourne not come around, we'd have probably just continued sort of doing that and kind of grinding out these our day-to-day sort of the balance until it got totally unbearable. So to have a moment where you had to, it was clearly a fork in the road, and it was either, and then we had another conversation then, the same way we did when we graduated. We're like, okay, well, here it is. Do we go to Melbourne, which is completely outrageous offer that we've been given, that we could never, we couldn't fund this ourselves. Do we go to travel to the other side of the planet and perform comedy in a different continent for the first time ever? Or do we not do that? And if we don't do that, does that mean we're possibly not particularly into this whole idea? So it came to the point where we realized that there was no way in hell that we couldn't do that, because had we not gone to Melbourne, every time I'd ever heard anyone mention the word Australia or bumped into an Australian person, I'd have just felt a little bit of my soul fall off, and
that can happen anyway.
Crumble. Well, I mean, yeah, it doesn't need any help. Jesus, I'm holding on to what remnants I've got left. So we decided to do it, and then from there we've just been pushing forward obstinately in the face of all logic.
I find
just
myself
never check your bank balance is my advice.
I find myself always being jealous of double acts and sketch groups, because you get to share it all with someone. Obviously, you get half the money as well. But
I thought it doubles if you're in a double. Yeah.
But
quick, get us out.
You get to share it with someone. You get to share the journey with someone. You get to share the literal car journeys with someone. And I find one of the
Max always falls asleep in the car.
Oh, great company.
Yeah. Makes up for writing the show.
Something
that you'll know is a preoccupation of mine in doing these interviews is the isolating effect of stand-up and how depressing and anxiety-ridden the life of a stand-up can be. Do you find that because you seem to be happy, well-adjusted people enjoying working together. Is comedy filling some sort of void in your life? Are the pair of you filling a void in your life? Is there something motivating you to be performing comedy and with all the risks associated with that? Other than this is just a bloody good laugh.
Well, I mean, you have to be obviously some sort of perennial show off to decide that this is your vocation in life, and it's very much an uphill, battle to get to write a show and to get to Edinburgh and to remain resolutely convinced that this is in fact your calling when it's such an unlikely profession to have. There's obviously some sort of compulsion there, but I don't think it comes from any particularly unhealthy or dark place. I think it's just very enjoyable to do. Come on, say something juicy. Admit an addiction or something.
Oh no, I'm really sorry. It's just really lovely, and I've got a girlfriend who keeps me grounded. And
what a couple of dicks, honestly.
We're both in super long-term relationships and we just love doing it. Sorry, we're not addicted to drugs and the drug of performing, guys. That's what we're addicted to.
As punishment,
to.
I'm going to end the show there.
No!
We've probably got time for one more question, if you can help out Max and Ivan from finishing this episode as I fade up the twiddly guitar music. What a marvellously phrased question. I think you can come again. Presumably, you were reading different subjects as undergraduates. How did you get together and know that you were going to be funny together?
Well, we were reading subtly different subjects. Ivan was doing straight
up... And sorry, if I could just interrupt. This is going to be the last question. So however you finish this answer is going to be really... That's going to be the calling card. It better be poignant.
Right. Well, you can start sort of singing in a sort of harmonious way at the end. Yeah, in a minute. We were reading subtly different subjects. Ivan was doing straight up drama and theatre studies. I was doing drama and creative writing, that well respected joint honours degree.
Both legit degrees.
Absolutely, totally legit. Royal Holloway, University of London. We both got cast in the same show, not the horror Edinburgh thing, but another one. And I think we just sat around, even in the audition, I think we started chatting about comedy for some reason. And we planned to write a radio show together, which is a thing we ended up doing in Edinburgh. Sure. But you know, first year of university being what it was a bit of a bleary haze of a few months. We didn't do that, but Ivan did end up booking us in to the Laughing Horse New Act of the Year competition, which we had no idea what it was. And performing as the two characters, the Argentinian folk singing characters that Ivan came up with his and then I added mine when I was off wrestling in Italy, we went off and did these Laughing Horse gigs. And not having the slightest clue how comedy worked, we were like, oh, they want us to do 6 minutes. So we wrote 6 minutes and then we got through and then we wrote another 6 minutes and then we got through again and wrote another 6 minutes. So we didn't realise that you could just quite literally do the same thing each time. So we wrote quite a good 6 minutes. Then we wrote an amazingly good 6 minutes that I'm still very proud of. And then we completely burnt ourselves out and wrote this baffling series of nonsense. My girlfriend at the time was in the audience, first time she'd seen us perform.
And there was my girlfriend's parents as well were in the audience. We performed this harrowing 6 or 7 minutes of something. And as we walked off to silence, there was a woman who said to her friend, "What the fuck was that?"
Oh. And on the basis of that, we decided that we'd work together for the rest of our lives.
Excellent. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. You'll notice I've conspicuously not foraged into Max's past as a wrestler. That's a tale for another time. And there is some video footage of that available on YouTube. So would you please join me in thanking Max and Ivan? Thanks, guys.
So that was Max and Ivan. As I said, absolutely lovely guys, as you can hear. Very intelligent, very, very funny. Do try and get to see their shows if you can. I don't know if they're going up to Edinburgh this year. I would imagine that they're going up and smashing it again. So look out for them. That's everything. Come and see me in New Zealand. Come and see the recording with Carey Marks. Look forward to Claudia O'Doherty next week, and that'll do us for now. Thank you to Sarah Grun for the Podmin. Thank you for James Lowy and also to Pete Jones for their audio and visual help during the recording of that episode. Remember youtube.com/comcompod for this and several of the other. I think we've got 8 or 9 videos on there now. A little 10-minute edited highlights reel if you'd like to see what we look like. And also those are a lovely thing. If you like the show, then you can put them on people's Facebook pages and stuff like that and say, hey, look at this thing I'm into. Also, you can download an hour of it. That would be useful. Thank you so much for the donations. Really appreciate it. If you go to comedianscomedian.com, there's a PayPal button there you can click on and donate and support the podcast. I'm not going to hammer that every time. You know it's there. But if you liked it, you know, a pound a show, why not? Or just a fiver. Not, well, a fiver a show would be lovely, but just, you know, a one-off thing, whatever you like. Golly. Right, next time, I'll do it written down. I won't look out the window. Thank you very much for listening. Next week, Claudia O'Doherty, the last Edinburgh Fringe pre-recorded show, and I will speak to you then. Thanks for listening. Sorry about all the blurb. Bye.
Hold up. Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.